The following program is intended as an educational program, not as investment advice or as a recommendation to buy, sell, or participate in any investment vehicle, product, offering, or strategy. Investment advisory services are offered through Turning Point Financial, a registered investment advisor. Any references to specific securities, investment vehicles, or strategies are intended only as examples, not as recommendations. All investments involve risk, including the possibility of losing money. Welcome to Money in Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. Do you ever wonder how your money and the things you own are actually helping you to live out what you really feel called to in your heart? You know, there's so much peace of mind that comes when you sense that your money is aligned with your values and your convictions, as well as your financial goals. And there's a whole lot of anxiety and worry and all the stuff in that category, right, that comes along when you sense that that alignment isn't present.
That's right, but it's easier said than done. There's so much financial information coming at us every minute of every day. It can actually be overwhelming. Terminology, ideas and philosophies, various competing principles, and of course, financial products and services. Keeping all of this information straight can be downright confusing and possibly even scary.
And when you're confused, you simply aren't making good decisions. And that can keep you from being all that God wants you to be. And it can hurt you pretty badly as well. Well, welcome again to Money and Mission. I'm James Good.
And I am Eric Terrio. Each week, in the first part of our show, we'll talk about some current financial events so you'll have a better understanding of what some of the terminology and events actually mean.
And usually we'll get to our weekly puzzler. but we've got a lot to cover here this week, and it's very seasonal. Because we are in a presidential election season, mm-hmm. or the election season, however we want to call that, and so we'll forego the puzzler this week.
Yeah, and normally this would be the time when we jump into our week in review, but it is a big week here this election season, so we want to jump into that.
So, it's important, I think, to note that, you know, the markets do react different ways to elections.
Absolutely.
And it's really never a good idea to try to guess maybe, you know, exactly how things are going to act or react. But we've talked a number of times about how an economy is just a series of transactions. And so the way that the government sets priorities, spending priorities is an important part of that transactional chain. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to talk about that here because it impacts things that happen to us in our portfolios and in the economy as a whole. But there is a difference between fiscal policy and monetary policy. And fiscal policy really is what happens when the president and Congress set budgets and spending priorities, and monetary policy is what happens when the Fed does things to interest rates and so on and so forth. So we want to talk in this segment about the big picture overview of the president's influence on financial policy or fiscal policy, and then we'll talk about some history, mm-hmm. as we go through the podcast here today. So we already said that, you know, financial markets react differently to different political parties that might be in power, and that's simply because the different parties have different agendas.
Sure.
They have different ways of approaching life. And so in the United States—
So depending on what administration goes into power, then it could have a big influence on how things end up for us.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. One direction or another. And it's been that way throughout the entire history of our country. And we'll be talking about some of those things as we go here. That's right. But so here in the United States, the president and Congress are supposed to work together to set fiscal policy,
mm-hmm.
right? We hear about things, terms like gridlock, and that simply just means that the ideas that are being passed around in, or that are, the ideas that are being debated anyway in Washington, that there is not an agreement and the two parties can't agree on how to move things forward. And so things get stalled in gridlock. Which is sometimes frustrating, but it's also a benefit of our form of government that it takes a while for things to happen. And what's supposed to happen is that those ideas are supposed to be thoroughly debated so that we consider carefully the benefits and disadvantages of different courses of action.
That's right. But I also heard the phrase that the power of the purse lies with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, the president has a big role to play as well, not just guiding that, but also signing off on that, right?
Signing off on that, yeah. So what happens is that, again, together, the president and Congress are supposed to work together to determine how much money the government spends and what the government actually spends money on. The president is supposed to propose a budget. And of course, that's, you know, we talk with clients all the time. Do you have a budget?
Right.
People don't like that word, budget. Right. Hey, we call it the B word, right? You know, do we have a budget? But a budget, really, it's a spending plan. And when you sit down and look at a budget, whether you're an individual or a business or a government, what you're really doing is you're determining what is important and where your money is going to go. So a budget represents priorities and what different people think are important. So the president proposes a budget, and that administration, again, they have spending priorities and things they're trying to get done. The president then sends that budget to Congress. And that is where you potentially start running into a debate.
Mm.
Because if the president is a Democrat and Republicans are really more influential in that season of Congress, then you have an opposing view that looks at that budget.
And even inside of that, the constituents of those representatives.
That's right.
I mean, they all have different priorities.
That's right.
And so there's a lot of push-pull that goes on.
That's right. And so you have hundreds of Congress people there, people filling Congress or roles in Congress, and they look at this budget and usually they don't agree. Usually. And so the debate gets started. So the president has now created a budget and sent it to Congress. Congress then is supposed to look at that and determine how much spending would be required to meet the president's budget and how much money has to get raised in the form of taxes to meet the president's budget. And of course, you have all those topics for people to debate and argue about, and that goes around and around.
And that's how we get government shutdown.
That's exactly right. So Congress creates a budget or a federal budget that specifies then how much money the government can spend in the upcoming year. And Congress also votes on legislation that says, hey, it's okay to put this amount of money over here or over here or over here. That's called an appropriation.
Right.
When they say, here we have money, but you know, we need to approve its spending first. So after Congress looks at that, then they send the budget back to the president. And the president at that point can either sign and approve the budget or veto the budget. But the president really cannot make specific changes. So if the president doesn't like the budget, he or maybe she can say, oh, I'm not approving the budget. I'm sending it back to Congress. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back and forth and back and forth. But the executive branch, the president heads up the executive branch, and the executive branch then can influence the economy through like the way they manage trade with other nations. They can set policy like tariffs, so the policy that the executive branch sets, again, it sets the tone for trade between nations, and that can make a big difference in things like our trade deficit and inflation and so on. The executive branch through the Treasury can also print currency and adjust spending. And so whatever ideas a president has and the president's advisors go back and forth. But those are the ideas that are going to get promoted and debated during that season of government. And that makes a big difference in terms of, you know, again, how the nation thinks and what kinds of topics become priorities economically as well.
And potentially long term, like the FDR, we'll get into that later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain tax bills that go throughout history, they reverberate.
That's right.
Down the line.
That's exactly right. So a couple of examples of things. I mean, it's one thing to talk about things like tax policy and all the, you know, all this stuff sounds so whatever out there. But, you know, an example of tax policy would be a question of whether or not Social Security will be taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Or yep. How it will be taxed, at what level, and so on. So when a president forwards that kind of an idea and it becomes law, then it makes a very boots on the ground, you know, difference for people who are receiving Social Security's income. Another example of tax policy are things like the qualified small business tax deduction, again, which directly impacts qualified small businesses around the country. One of the examples of then like spending priorities, of course, you know, when the Republicans have the majority in government, then spending priorities are things like national defense. Democrats would probably negotiate that by asking for increases in non-defense spending.
Mm-hmm.
And if Democrats have the majority, then other priorities come up, like social safety net expansions, things like Medicare and prescription drugs and so on and so forth. So depending who's there. Oh, and in a divided government, of course, then projecting spending changes would be really tough to figure out because it's a pretty even draw, and nobody really has enough of a majority to move any of those down the proverbial field and get them across the goal line.
And we have a gridlock.
And we have a gridlock. That's right. Yeah. So who's in? You know, who's really more influential in Washington? It does make a difference. It makes sense to have an investment plan to stick with it, but it does make a difference in that regard.
We're out of time in this segment, so we're going to take a quick break. But when we do come back, we want to jump into some of American history throughout time with fiscal and monetary policy. You're listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio.
Welcome back to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where we talk each week about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. I'm James.
And this is Eric.
And we just finished talking about, in segment one here, the influence that presidents and Congress and political parties have on the economy and monetary policy and the way things work. It's so important to recognize that that impacts us, right? We don't encourage people to make, you know, lots of changes in their investment plan just because another political party gets in power, but certainly there's a big difference that gets made. And when we study history, we see places in time where the president and the Congress made specific decisions that had lasting effect on actually the entire history of our country.
Oh, yeah.
And so we want to spend a little bit of time talking about that history. I understand you are a history buff.
I like to think so.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. History of all kinds, too, but especially when it comes to our country.
Yeah. That's right. Well, judging by the, you know, the time that we see that you look at history, I would say you're a history buff.
Yeah. Well, I take it as a compliment.
Yeah. Especially the financial history. And I really, I mean, I said that because that's the very first bullet point you have here on our notes. But we take things for granted here today that we have a dollar that is rather accepted all the way across our country and around the world.
Yeah, around the world even.
Right. But it really, you know, it really wasn't always that way.
No, it sure wasn't. So let's kind of jump into some of the history of our country and how we got to where we are today.
That's right.
Starting even way back with the birth of our financial system. And I have some notes here. We can just kind of walk through each of these points and talk about them a little bit.
Yeah. But you have this American Revolution going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
As the colonies at that point are splitting apart from
the British.
The British Empire, right? Mm-hmm. Which was the big dominant economic force around the whole entire globe.
Sure.
At that time for what? Hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
So this
economic,
was,
military might.
That's right. And just really, really entrenched. So when you have an economic system that tries to break away like that, one of the first things they have to do is decide how are they going to function together.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone how are they going to be accepted by the rest of the world, but how are they going to function together internally?
And that policies, currency.
Yeah, it includes
institutions.
That's right. It includes deciding what they're going to do with their money.
Yeah. And what is money?
And what is money?
Right.
Yeah.
Because in that war, in the Revolutionary War in 1775, the Continental Congress authorized issuance of what's called the Continental Currency.
That's right.
To help finance their war effort.
And before that, it was the British currency, mm-hmm. or the English currency.
That's right.
The English pound.
That's correct.
So suddenly.
So that was early adoption, right?
That's right.
Day one, even pre-day.
That's right.
Of our nation.
Which made the English as thrilled as anything, I suppose.
No.
No.
Quite the opposite.
I mean, and if you were fighting a war like that and you had these colonies that were trying to split off, you'd probably be looking to do everything you could to destabilize. I mean, they were your enemy, really, at that. Although it was kind of interesting because if you study some of the time periods like that, I would have to think that there were factions of the English government. They weren't really enemies. I mean, they probably, you know, the colonies meant a lot to them. And so there was probably, it wasn't just, hey, we're enemies. It was really we have different political opinions and we couldn't work out our differences. And so here we are and we're fighting a war.
Yeah, and it was a large chunks of some people's lives.
That's right.
The effort they put into that.
That's right.
And like you said, the British weren't happy. So one of the big downfalls of the Continental Currency was counterfeiting. So the British were trying to destabilize us by counterfeiting those bills.
Wow. And probably a lot of other counterfeiting going on as well, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Opportunists who were like, we're going to do this.
Mm-hmm. What's that made out of?
Right. But then every colony had its own idea.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually those colonies became states. And I understand at the very outset that every one of those states had a different currency.
They did. That's correct. And a lot of that, you know, there was rapid depreciation of that continental currency due to a lack of a sound backing to what those dollars were based upon. As well as those that currency counterfeiting efforts really dropped down the price of those dollars fell apart basically.
Yeah, which is something we don't think about. I mean, we think about things that feel chaotic in our world today, but can you imagine what it would feel like if every one of the states here in the United States of America had its own currency?
Mm. No.
I mean, I'd like to think that Pennsylvania's currency would be it.
Yeah.
You know, but it may not be because there are other states in the union that maybe have a stronger economic base than Pennsylvania, or it might ebb and flow back and forth. That would be a mess.
Mm-hmm. And it did have a significant impact on the economy. The depreciation of those bills caused significant inflation and economic hardship during the war.
All the way back at the very beginning of our country.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I never knew, but I suppose, you know, somewhere along the way, people came to the realization that this whole thing of having each state with its own currency, like this just isn't working.
Yeah, that was not a good idea.
And so a president Was it a president that came up with the idea of having a national currency, or was that more of a
founding father?
It was a founding father.
Yes.
So, but I can only imagine that the debates in that conversation, you know, deciding is this going to be a state's thing, or is this going to be a federal government thing? What role does the federal government play in currency, and you know, who really decides this? That's such an important policy decision.
Well, it has just to like have... now today, there's Republicans and Democrats. A big part of our founding politics were Federalists and non-Federalists.
Mm.
Some people were more strict to the Constitution, and they felt like the federal government has a limited amount of power, and what is not specifically given to it falls to the states. And then there was other folks who felt like a more centralized authority and bigger government was better for the states. And they severely debated a lot of those topics on that issue.
Yeah. And just things we don't think about today. Again, sometimes we think that we're in a chaotic world today, but I can only imagine the level of chaos that would have created as that idea was being debated and really just, you know, just tossed around, trying to find direction and trying to find agreement in how we're going to function together as a country.
Yep, that's right. And then fast forward just a couple decades, and then Alexander Hamilton helped establish the first bank of the United States. So
there really weren't any banks? I mean, it seemed like there would have to be some kind of
place to actually house the money, sure.
Right, that's right.
But an actual first bank of the United States, where the government played a very big role. And it actually, the government held a 20% ownership stake in that.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, probably because, you know, coming out of the Revolutionary War, the nation, I mean, we have debt today.
Mm.
But we're an established economy. We're an established nation. If you were coming out of a war, like the Revolutionary War, and you were just getting started as a nation,
mm-hmm.
and you had debt because of the war you just fought, then not only are you trying to figure out how to pay the debt, but you're trying to figure out how the economy is even supposed to work.
Right. Right.
So a financial crisis really is taking place in that first 10 or 20 years, and this bank then becomes one of the ways of starting to address that financial crisis.
Yeah, it played a key role in stabilizing our economy.
Mm-hmm.
For sure did.
Yeah. But certainly, you know, again, the Constitution didn't explicitly say, hey, the federal government has the power to create a bank.
That was not a bullet point in the Constitution. No, it was not.
So you have a debate.
Mm-hmm.
More debate.
Right? More debate.
And
more gridlock.
That's right. But Thomas Jefferson was a president.
So he was our third president.
Our third president.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the first segment, we talked about how presidents, whoever's in power in Congress and the White House, has this, those are the ideas that get promoted, and those are the ideas that make their way into the national agenda. So Thomas Jefferson has a vision for how a bank or the banking system really could be used to address this financial crisis that we had going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so his leadership and his idea were important in the formation of that first bank.
Right. And then some time passes, and then we get into the adoption of the gold standard in 1879.
Mm-hmm.
And
so one other question on that first bank, though.
Mm-hmm.
The president, Thomas Jefferson, kind of conceived the idea. Did the government actually have any ownership in that bank?
Yes, they had 20%.
A 20% ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And then private investors, I guess, would have held the rest.
Sure, yep, that's right. Correct.
So that bank...
And it issued paper money, made loans to the government and businesses, and acted as a depository for federal funds.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you had the beginnings of what today is the banking system. Mm-hmm. A lot of changes, a lot of things evolved from then until now, but certainly
it turned into a whole new beast.
That's right. That was the very beginning of that.
Yeah.
But money at that point was still just gold was used as a medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So precious metals were in play.
Mm-hmm.
But when a bank starts to issue money, then there is this debate of how much this money is actually worth.
Right.
And how does anybody decide what the value of that money actually happens to be?
And it gets particularly more difficult when it's not necessarily backed by a finite amount of precious metals.
By anything. Yeah. That's right. And yeah, that is particularly difficult because, again, by the time it travels from here to the southern part of the country, anybody could change their mind in terms of what it's actually worth.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for us to think about that because we're just not used to that. We don't live in that kind of world. But that's actually the way things got started at the outset of the United States.
That's right. Well, we're all out of time for this segment. When we come back, we'll jump into the rest of the history. And you are listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio.
Welcome back to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. And we are talking today about the history of presidents.
And their administrations.
And their administrations and some of the decisions they made that impact money as we know it today,
mm-hmm.
right? In the first
key segment. Turning points of our nation's past.
That's right. I mean, in the first segment, we talked about how when different political parties get in power, they have different priorities in terms of policy and spending, and the decisions they make, again, influence and have long-lasting influences. And some of that shows up in our money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about how our...
What dollars are backed by.
That's right. And how the United States currency got started back way back at the beginning of our country. And it feels like we sort of ended our last segment with, hey, there's a bank. The bank is issuing some money, but there's not really a common agreement on what that money is worth.
That's correct. So let's, you know, fast forward to the gold standard in our country. Historically, other countries have used different standards, but there was no uniform system, whether it be of gold or silver or precious metals. So it started to really take form in the 1800s.
Yeah, I think to really understand the history of the U.S. monetary system, we have to really understand the role of this, what it means to back a currency with something like a precious metal, like gold or silver. Because what that currency is viewed as being valuable as then ties back to whatever it's worth, whatever it's tied to, mm-hmm. at the moment, right?
And that matters what you can buy.
That's right. So, but I do think that for the first couple of hundred years that the United States was in what was a thing, was a country, that there was some version of a metallic standard. And from 1792, now, I mean, you noted here that there was an adoption of a gold standard in 1879, but it seemed to me that from like the late 1700s, like 1790, 92 or so, up until the mid 1830s, that silver was maybe the primary backing for the currency. And then in the 1800s, the U.S. began transitioning to the gold standard.
Yeah, the classical gold standard.
The classical gold standard.
It was in the 1870s.
But what's really interesting there, again, is that the idea to actually make that happen had to come from somewhere. So there was a government leader, a president somewhere, needed to set out this idea and say, hey, we want to make this happen. And then there was some debate that occurred and so on and so forth. And eventually everybody agreed that that's the way the nation was going to run. So, again, presidents become super important in that whole conversation. But gold then became the standard way for the government to ensure the value of its currency. And I think we've talked before about gold. It's on the periodic table of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is seen and viewed as a very stable and very reliable source of value. Advocates, I think, believe that it would promote stability in the value of currency and the value of prices. And since it was rather recognized around the globe, that then the United States currency would be able to be used to buy and sell things with other nations as well.
Mm-hmm. And there was periods of our history where we went off the standard and back on the standard, suspended that gold standard, but it was always a prominent part of our money.
Yeah. But initially, you know, initially the move from just paper money to a gold-backed currency, I think, had a deflationary effect. So an inflationary effect is where money becomes worth less and less. And if all of a sudden you start backing that money with something that has more stability and more value, well, then the dollar becomes worth more and more. And so it takes fewer and fewer dollars to buy the same amount of stuff,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to an inflationary world where it takes more and more dollars to buy the same amount of stuff. And so that kind of deflationary impact, that was the initial impact, actually, of moving to the gold standard. And so the dollar became worth a lot at that particular point.
Yeah, and like I said, we've went off a couple times. Once during it was suspended during the Civil War, converting paper money to gold, and that led to the issuance of what are considered greenbacks.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have heard that term before. Paper money not backed by precious metal.
Right.
And also during the Great Depression. They required U.S. citizens to surrender their gold holdings to the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, before that, even in the 1700s, and, you know, we're just kind of going back and forth through history here, the Coinage Act
mm-hmm.
of 1972, the Coinage Act actually established the United States Mint, and which produced and circulated coinage then around the United States. So suddenly people had coins. And I believe at the time that the gold to silver ratio was set at 15 to 1, which means that 1 ounce of gold would be able to buy 15 ounces of silver.
Mm.
And you still, even in the financial markets today, you still have this gold and silver ratio thing going on, but it's a lot different than it was at the time.
Yeah, and then 1971, Nixon took us off that gold standard.
That's right.
And we went to a fiat currency.
That's right. Well, who was, it was FDR, actually, I guess, that came out and said that Americans were not allowed to own gold.
Yes, during the Great Depression.
During the Great Depression.
Lots of problems going on, and I guess they made a very hasty and desperate decision.
That's right.
Of just hoarding all the gold at the Federal Reserve.
But dollars were still backed by gold at that particular point. So, but, you know, the point really is not so much the history of money, so much as when a president came into power and Congress was there and, you know, the president and Congress were setting policy together and they came up with the idea that nobody was allowed to own gold.
Mm.
And that had an impact.
Sure.
Right. Later, when Nixon comes up with the idea that we should come off of the gold standard, he did so because he had some ideas about a problem that he was trying to address. And so, you know, a president came into power and started promoting some ideas. Had to get Congress's support, but eventually made some decisions on those ideas and made a big difference,
mm-hmm.
and made a big difference in how the world pursued or how the world proceeded, really, really from that point. So, you know, I think really, again, the point that we're trying to make here is that different political parties come into power and they have different ideas about how things are going to look, and they look at the problems and the opportunities around them in the world and make decisions, and then the world changes because of those decisions. For every action, there is an equal or greater reaction. And it has been that way since the very beginning of our country, right? And literally every other country in the world has a history where kings and queens and presidents and parliaments have come into power, and they've looked at problems and opportunities, and they made decisions, and those decisions impacted and changed the world in which people lived.
Well, how about another big decision was, let's jump forward to the creation of the Federal Reserve. I know this is a topic that you love, and we talk about often here on the podcast.
Yeah, or maybe not love, as the case might be.
Need to understand.
We need to understand. That's right. Because the Federal Reserve does. It has such an impact. Decisions that are made at the Federal Reserve have such an impact on how much it costs to get money and how much money is in existence and how much purchasing power is out there. So, yeah, the list goes on and on like that. And I honestly think we're down to like 2 minutes or something here. So I'm not sure if that was supposed to be a segue to the next segment.
Yeah, trying to move us along here.
You're trying to move it along. That's right.
We got a lot to get to.
Because we have a lot of pages to cover. All right. Well, I'll get off my little topic then about, you know, kings and queens and parliaments and presidents. But
well, I think it ties right in because you're saying they have a lot of influence. And then In 1913, established under President Woodrow Wilson, was the Federal Reserve Act. And this is what created our Federal Reserve. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, our country saw repeated financial panics. And, you know, these crises highlighted the weaknesses of the existing decentralized nature of our banking system, where banks operated independently and lacked any sort of central authority to provide support during times of stress.
Mm-hmm. But again, that whole system was conceived of or promoted by a president.
That's correct.
And so again,
and a big change.
So again, the ideas that a president brought forward made a big, big difference in how the country was shaped for decades, many decades, and probably decades to come as well.
And the goal of the Fed was to provide a safer, more flexible, and stable monetary system. And I think they're doing an okay job, but we have our opinions.
That's right. We do have our opinions. We do have our opinions on that. But again, we can't get away from the idea that this came because there were presidents that had ideas. Mm-hmm. And we are in the middle of, you know, an election time here in our country. We have regular elections that come up, and the people that are voted into office make a difference because of the ideas that they promote and set forth. So I think, you know, we'll finish talking about this as we get into the final segment here today. And it's so fascinating to me to see and to think on how these different people and their ideas literally have shaped what we call money today, how that money works, and the value it has or doesn't have.
And we hear folks in our current day, you know, espousing this topic or their opinion on this, but we don't really take into account how that will change things in the future. We look back at all these events, we're like, that was a turning point. That was a turning point. Mm-hmm. That was a turning point. We could be standing right in front of one right now.
That's right.
Well, we're all out of time in this segment. When we come back, we will finish up on this presidential history lesson. You are listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio.
Welcome back to Money in Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. I'm James.
And this is Eric.
And we are talking today about presidents and political parties that had influence and ideas on our nation's history and the economics of our nation's history and even money as we know it today.
And the new direction that will effectively take place.
That's right. So, and I think we ended up with, as we were coming out of the third segment, we ended up with President Woodrow Wilson, mm-hmm. who had conceived the Federal Reserve Act, and that got the whole Federal Reserve system up and running to begin with. And regardless of your view on the Federal Reserve, Woodrow Wilson arguably was enormously influential because the policy that he set up there has shaped our nation's history for the last 100 years or so.
Certainly.
And so after Woodrow Wilson, I guess Woodrow Wilson was also then, he was president during the war, right? World War One. Yeah. So time goes along and now Herbert Hoover becomes the president and we end up with a Great Depression.
Yes.
That's right.
1929.
And that's right. And 2 years in, 2 or 3 years into the Great Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt is elected president.
That's right.
And he's got some ideas.
He does. He wanted to get the country out of the turmoil that we have just found ourselves in. And he had a big slogan back then. It was relief, recovery, and reform.
Yeah. Franklin D. Roosevelt wants to get us out of this mess.
That's right.
It's amazing to me how many presidents have run for office on the idea of getting us out of this mess.
Probably just about all of them.
Just about all of them.
They thought things were perfect. They probably wouldn't be running.
That's exactly right. So Franklin D. Roosevelt proposes something called the New Deal, mm-hmm. and that's still debatable even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And critics argued, I guess, that it expanded the government too much, while supporters said, hey, there was a positive social impact. But still, he set forth that idea, and it had a dramatic impact.
Yes.
At the time. Now, Franklin D. Roosevelt was also the president during the time where what was set up was the Bretton Woods system. And the whole Bretton Woods system was proposed by John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, and I was a little unfamiliar with this until I dove into it. So
yeah,
that was interesting to find out about the Bretton Woods system.
Right. Yeah. So John Maynard Keynes was actually a British economist who was an advisor to the English Treasury or England's Treasury. So, but, you know, there's an example, of course, the president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, gave an opportunity for John Maynard Keynes's ideas to float to the surface and to become influential. So again, when we talk about how influential different political parties are, there's just a number of different ways that that influence becomes real.
Yeah, but like we said at the onset, the president has the power to sign those bills that Congress mm-hmm. pass. And throughout the history of the different segments we've been talking, each one of them, there was a president who was able to be in power and had the authority to affect that change. Mm-hmm. But they also had smart people around them.
They had smart, that's right.
Economists, policymakers, scholars who could give them these good ideas because they don't know everything. But they can take those ideas and help implement them and push them through.
That's right. So it's not just the president or the Congress that's in, but their staff and their advisors.
And who they choose to have around them.
And who they choose to have around them. So that becomes so important. So Franklin D. Roosevelt goes on. The Bretton Woods system stays in place for a little bit. The number of years, the U.S. dollar at that point was pegged to gold at $35 an ounce, and it kind of stayed that way until President Nixon in the early 70s. And
that shift to fiat currency.
Mm-hmm. Again, a major policy type of decision that was tremendously impactful for decades in the future.
So now no longer was our dollar backed by a commodity like gold. Mm-hmm. Its value is now being derived from government decree and public confidence.
Pretty much. That's right. So then, of course, you know, a number of years go by and Ronald Reagan comes into the presidency, and Ronald Reagan then really conceived of the idea of the North American Free Trade Act, or as we know today, NAFTA. And that opened trade between Mexico and the United States and Canada.
North America Free Trade Agreement.
North American Free Trade Agreement, yeah. Mm-hmm. And wow, what a tremendous influence that had, too, in terms of where the United States was buying stuff. And when we talk about trade deficits, a lot of that got started in that era.
Yeah, I think the relationship was like a lot of resources from Canada, a lot of the labor from Mexico, and
that's right.
Kind of thought that working that together would be a good idea.
That's right. So the Clinton administration really took off on that North American Free Trade Agreement, and at least the initial impact here to the United States was that, you know, the influx of cheaper goods and or cheaper stuff made it possible for a rise in the standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the long-term impact of that was something that it was very advisable or not remains really to be seen. But at least the initial impact was very positive, at least here for the United States.
Mm-hmm. A lot of critics, though, say that, you know, over the years that allowed a lot of that manufacturing to go outside of of our country, though.
That's right, yeah. But it was an influential policy decision.
Absolutely.
Right. G.W. Bush at the turn of the century and from 2000 until about 2008, of course, you know, G.W. Bush had the idea of everyone should own a home. And so it was very easy to get credit and to buy personal residences. And well, that idea kind of ended with a not very good experience in what we now know as the Great Recession.
There are chapters and textbooks about that now.
That's right. That's right. And then the Obama administration comes in. And of course, Mr. Obama had some ideas, and every one of these guys had ideas that they were setting forth and putting out there. And those ideas turn into policy, and the policy turns into actions. Mr. Obama was the president during the time of following that Great Recession.
Mm-hmm, coming out of that.
And of course, now the Federal Reserve was also operating there, and the president operates separately from the Federal Reserve, but the two somewhat function, you know, they're influential together.
And that was the worst global recession since the Great Depression of the 30s.
It was.
Of the crash in 29.
It was. That's mm-hmm. right. So President Obama had ideas about how to get through that, and many of those ideas involved changes that needed to take place in our system. So again, influential in that way. And then, of course, you know, following the Obama administration, then we had President Trump, and that brings us current to today. And we know that there has been a lot of debate about ideas and topics and policy things that different people would do if they become president of the United States. And one thing I wanted to really just encourage our listeners, it's easy to kind of get into the history and the details, and we have feelings and we have opinions about different policy and or lack thereof, as the case might be. But, you know, the Bible tells us that we are supposed to pray for our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we really forget that. With the level of influence that these people have and the decisions and the policy and how it just steers the course of a country and of the entire world, I think we really need to take that to heart.
Absolutely.
And to really, you know, again, pray for our leaders. We're so blessed to be in a country where we can be engaged. We are able to write letters to and you know, have conversations with the folks that are representatives. And so I just, you know, again, I want to encourage our listeners to be involved
mm-hmm.
in that way.
Yes, participate.
Participate. And
in this great experiment we call America.
And this great, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget to pray for our government leaders. Sometimes I honestly watch some of the topics and things that come across some of their desks. And I think to myself, I am sure glad that I'm not sitting in that chair. I do not know why anybody would want to.
And the thing that really takes me back sometimes is, you know, FDR went in with a clear idea mm-hmm. of what he thought he wanted to do. Trump went in with his idea of what he thought he wanted to do. But I think both of those were pretty good examples of how things took a turn for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
FDR thought he was going to clean up the Great Depression, and what happened while he was in office? World War II kicked off. So I'm sure a lot of the things that he wanted, either A, may not have got done or got derailed because he had new items on his agenda that he had to take care of.
That's right.
Trump went in, he had ideas for the economy and for regulations and things like that. And then what happened? The pandemic happened.
That's right.
And it kind of twisted everything around. So even if they had a path that they wanted to run on, and further to your point, pray for them. Because things take a turn and they have to make very, very tough decisions sometimes that affect all of us.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I'm sure that probably not any one of the presidents that we've had ever, somebody suddenly had to deal with this crisis. They did not come into office, as you said, with that idea mm-hmm. that particular crisis was going to be the defining moment of how people remembered their presidency. But still, again, they had to make those decisions, and so we hold those people up in prayer.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I thought that was a great show. Nice little civics lesson, nice little history lesson.
That's right.
We could have dove in a lot deeper on everything, but I think we covered a lot of the main parts.
There are always things you could go deeper on, and there is always a thing called a clock.
That's right. And we're at the end of it now.
That's right.
But so thanks for tuning in this week.
That's right. You are listening to Holy Family Radio, WHYF, AM 720.